Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. Chinese President Xi Jinping signed $62 billion worth of economic deals with British Prime Minister David Cameron this week, including a $28 billion deal to finance nuclear power plants around the UK. The two sides also issued a joint statement declaring a global partnership, and David Cameron revealed his government had signed an additional agreement with China on preventing cyber espionage. In Tokyo, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced that he plans to attend the meetings in Paris for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, known as COP21, during early December. The new framework will replace the current Kyoto Protocol that obliges only industrial countries to cut emissions, with one that also includes developing countries' obligations. In Delhi, Indian External Affairs Minister Sushma Swaraj conducted a series of meetings with Russian counterparts, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Two countries discussed ways to boost their economic ties and triple their bilateral trade to $30 billion in the next decade. India will also join the Russia-China-led Shanghai Cooperation Organization next year. On the Korean Peninsula, reunions of families torn apart by the Korean War in the early 1950s took place at the Mount Kumgang Resort in North Korea. 389 South Koreans and 141 North Koreans from 96 different families separated during the war met, in many cases for the first time in more than 60 years. In the Philippines, relief efforts are underway following Typhoon Kopu's devastating landfall this week. 54 people have been reported killed and over 500,000 people displaced from their homes due to extensive coastal flooding. This week we feature a conversation hosted at CSIS by noted journalist Bob Schieffer, which reviewed the recent US-China summit. CSIS Freeman Chair Chris Johnson, former senior U.S. government official Dr. Kurt Campbell, and Financial Times Washington Bureau Chief Dmitry Sevastopoulou joined to discuss the outcomes from President Obama's meetings with President Xi and where the U.S.-China relationship is headed.
Gentlemen, let me just start off, and we have had the summit. President Xi Jinping was here. Chris and Kurt, I would just like to ask you both, as he goes back to China, what did we learn about him?
Well, I'm happy to start off. I think we learned several things. One is that President Xi very clearly articulated, I think, when he was here for the visit, what his hopes are for the U.S.-China relationship, which is to see at some level a recognition on the U.S. part that the mechanics of the relationship and the cadence of the relationship need to change in some fairly fundamental ways to take into account the reordering, if you will, of the global balance of power with China's growing rise and so on. This is very important to Xi Jinping. This is what's behind his conception of what he calls a new style of great power relations between the US and China, in which he sort of thinks of the relationship as being set above, if you will, all of the day-to-day bits of tension between our two sides. So whether that be cybersecurity or the South China Sea, numerous other issues where we've had recent friction. He wants to see the relationship elevated above that. And I think we saw that on display a few times during the summit, where I think President Xi was somewhat frustrated, as probably was President Obama, that you have the two leaders of these big economies, big countries, big important countries, and they're really in the weeds, talking about cybersecurity and a lot of these issues. I think there's a desire on both sides to try to elevate the relationship a little bit, and we see Xi Jinping very much wanting to do that. I think we also saw a president who, of course, we've seen this his whole tenure. Kurt knows this better than anyone, having seen him many times, who's very self-confident, who was speaking just as much to the audience at home as he was to the U.S. audience, in fact, much more so. This was especially true with regard to the pomp and circumstance of the visit, getting the 21-gun salute, the state dinner. All these things were very, very important to President Xi.
Kurt, what is he different than what we've seen in the Chinese leadership before? Is he something of the same? How did you evaluate
Great. That? Thank you, Bob, and congratulations on the role here at CSIS. And I want to thank Chris for bringing us together today. And it's good to be in this lovely CSIS setting. If you look at the great Chinese experiment or ambitions over the last 25 years, clearly the economy is the primary focus. But I think what a series of Chinese leaders have done, Bob, is try to put in place institutions and mechanisms that force collective decision making, right? And so I would say when Chris and I worked together in government, we had a pretty good sense about how decisions were teed up in the State Council, the Foreign Ministry, the People's Bank of China. We knew how they would be siphoned up into the Standing Committee, and we had a sense of how the various interests were weighed and then ultimately decided. What's fascinating, and I think pretty much underappreciated on the part of the United States, in 2 years, President Xi has basically dismantled this entire mechanism. And so the reason, one of the ironies is, the reason why you've got to talk about very small, detailed issues with President Xi is that no one else has any power to talk about them. And so the only challenge in a system in which almost all the decisions are made by the leader is that it forces the leader to make all the decisions. And so we're striking, we were talking before we came out, sometimes you meet with Chinese interlocutors, even very senior ones, and you can tell subtly in the intercourse that they're hoping to learn from you what you know about what's going on in their own system, which has never been my experience before. So I agree with Chris, he's a very strong leader. He's very determined. I will say, I do find that occasionally Chinese interlocutors who work closely with him will use words like impatient and occasionally impetuous, make immediate decisions. That's very unlike previous Chinese leaders. I think he's prepared to accept a higher level of tension in the relationship between the United States and China. I'll tell you, I thought he played a very steady hand. I think he came to the United States in a period where we in the United States had the rarest of things in the U.S.-China relationship. We had leverage. And I think they maneuvered very effectively to get a variety of things out of the summit, primarily, as Chris underscored, this respect, right? The sense that she is a strong leader, and he avoided some of the things that would weaken his domestic standing, particularly in the aftermath of a really substantial macroeconomic set of challenges, probably the worst in almost 20 years that played out over the summer. So I think she goes back to China somewhat relieved, and I think it is also the case that the burden of the management of the U.S.-China relationship has never rested so much on two people, President Obama and President Xi, in a world where they are both, as you said at the outset, consumed with other issues.
Dmitry, what do you think were the most important outcomes of the Obama-Xi summit? And talk to us a little bit about the United States relationship with China and Britain's relationship with China right now.
Sure. If I can also just add to something that Chris and Kurt said, I agree with them completely that Xi Jinping is probably the strongest Chinese leader since Deng Xiaoping and the way he's amassed power. But I think there are two things. If Donald Rumsfeld was here, he'd say there's one known unknown and one unknown unknown. The known unknown is that given the way the economy has performed over the summer and the way the Chinese technocrats have, by most measures, I think people think they've mismanaged what's happened. Xi is under a little bit more pressure than you would have been, given that the whole compact that the Chinese government has with its people is that we won't allow you to protest in Tiananmen Square, but we'll give you economic growth every year. If economic growth starts to subside too much, that's a problem for the leadership. And Xi Jinping, he can use Li Keqiang, the premier, who's ostensibly in charge of the economy, as a fall guy. On the other hand, because he's taken more control of things, he assumes a little bit more risk. I think the unknown unknown is that the flip side of his play for power is that he has, as everybody knows, engaged in an anti-corruption campaign for about 2 years. We know the big names that he's taken down, Zhou Yongkan, the security czar. But if you look at the whole panoply of cadres who've been either arrested, lost their jobs, put under house arrest, it's more than 100,000 people. And therefore, there are a lot of arrows pointing in the direction of Xi Jinping's back, and we don't know at some point whether one of those will be fired. So I would say he's very, very strong, but he also needs a lot of armor right now. On the US versus the UK approach to China, I think it's very interesting. The As Xi Jinping was preparing to come here, the Obama administration was debating whether to place sanctions on Chinese companies who are allegedly benefiting from commercial cyber espionage. And there was a big debate in the administration, and ultimately President Obama decided to hold off for now. But he publicly said, China better watch out. In the UK, Xi Jinping arrived yesterday, I believe. The British government has basically been haggling over whether they define the relationship with China as a golden era or a golden decade. And we wrote a piece about this morning. And I talked to a lot of Asia officials in Washington and even quoted one of them in the Financial Times this morning. I could not find a single American official who wasn't highly critical of the way Britain is playing the China relationship. And the criticism is essentially that the UK has decided that everything else is fine as long as we boost trade and generate Chinese investment, particularly in infrastructure and other sectors in the UK where money is badly needed. So I think there's a real divergence in the way the two countries are dealing with the rising Pacific power.
Well, what do you mean, though, with how? Give me an example of how the British approach is different than the American approach, and what?
Well, so George Osborne, the Chancellor, so the equivalent of the Treasury Secretary broadly, went to Xinjiang, the northwestern province in China, a very restive province where there's problems between the local ethnic Uyghurs, a Muslim minority group, and the Han Chinese and the Communist Party. As far as I know, he's the first senior Western politician to go there in a long time. And when he was there, he basically said, I want to take a risk on the China relationship because Britain really needs China. We want to be their biggest global partner. And ergo, the assumption was, therefore, we're not really going to raise questions about human rights. We're not going to be very aggressive in challenging China in terms of what they're doing in the South China Sea. And all of the places where the US criticizes China for perhaps not upholding the kind of norms, the international rules and regulations that have been in place for many decades, Britain is saying, although we were part of the structure of that, if China wants to go in a different direction, that's okay as long as they invest in our nuclear plants.
So let's talk about the new assertiveness by, for want of a better word, of China in the Pacific. And what does that mean, Chris? How far are they going to go? We know they're building islands now on reefs. What's this all about?
I think we have to step back a little bit and understand it in the broader context of, because exactly what's going on these individual islands and reefs on a day-to-day basis, it is sometimes challenging to know what their intentions might be. But where they've been very transparent since the day Xi Jinping arrived is in sort of laying out a very clear and broad maritime strategy that I think has the following components. The message is effectively that China will allow its forces, will operate its forces in that entire maritime domain out to the second island chain with Guam and into the Indian Ocean and that whole area at times of its choosing, perhaps even with impunity on occasion. And the regional neighbors, and particularly the United States, have to accept that. That's, I think, the bumper sticker of the message. We saw this right from the beginning. Interestingly, as the previous president, Hu Jintao, was departing, as every departing party secretary does at that particular party congress, he delivered the valedictory political work report, in which, in the 20,000-odd characters, there was one phrase, China is a maritime power, which is a simple sentence. So you say, okay, big deal. Well, no Chinese leader had uttered it in about 5,000 years somewhere, or yeah. 500 years. So they're back, you know, in the maritime space, basically. And we've seen Xi Jinping reinforce this at several points along his tenure, most recently at a major speech that he gave called a Foreign Affairs Work Conference, where he sort of set out his foreign policy vision, and then on the military side with some doctrinal changes that they made in a recent white paper that talk a lot about this maritime space. So they have a game plan. It's very clear what it is. And sometimes I think it's easy to get lost in the weeds of, you know, which particular island is being built and so on. But what we do see down there in the South China Sea is a defined strategy. They're putting these airstrips on these islands in a very particular fashion. And if you compare and contrast to, say, the last time we really had to think about this in a real crisis scenario, which would have been the 1995-96 Taiwan Strait crisis, At that time, that whole area was a strategic back reserve for the U.S. We could flow forces through there very easily without any problems, you know, and so on, if we needed to get involved in a Taiwan scenario with China. This building would greatly complicate that in the future, and also, of course, send signals to the region about U.S. commitment, et cetera.
Well, why, Kurt? I mean, what is the motivation here? Is this playing to nationalism because the economy is not very good? If that's the first, it wouldn't be the first time that a leader has chosen to do something like that. But what is it that is motivating China to do this? Because this is unlike China of the past, is it not?
There is a lot of historical reinterpretation that goes hand in hand with the idea of China re-rising. I'm not sure, it's a longer discussion. I would say that the current Chinese mindset really is about, for lack of a better word, creating spheres of influence. And I think they would, whenever I've seen under pressure in tense meetings with friends, Chinese interlocutors, and with other ASEAN, occasionally you will see a Chinese friend in exasperation say, "Do you not understand? We are a big power, and you are all small powers, and you need to understand that." And so I think one of the challenges that we're trying to do, I think the United States and other countries are trying to enlist China in a larger project, which is to sustain the mechanisms, the various protocols, the operating system of Asia, freedom of navigation, peaceful settlement of disputes, validity of contracts, that has basically given Asia 50 or 40 of its best years in 1,000, right? And for China to understand that investing in some of those mechanisms and procedures are in their best interests. But to be honest, rising powers are never comfortable just accepting the rules of the existing order. And so it's only natural that China wants to put its own stamp on things. And I think the key here is to try to find those areas where we can work with China that are not, you know, contradictory to the existing system. Like, I think we could have probably handled the AIIB a little bit more deftly. But then there are other areas where we have to be very clear. So what Chris laid out on the South China Sea, I completely agree with him that this issue gets obscured and misunderstood. And we focus very much on the islands. In truth, the big issue on the islands really is more the surrounding nations, their views, and they compete over these little specks of coral and sand. The real issue for us is that, Bob, this is a massive area, the South China Sea. And by most measures, this is now the central, most important strategic waterway in the world by tonnage and by value, even more important than the Persian Gulf. And if you listen very carefully to Chinese friends, what they are saying is that this is no longer an international waterway, right? That we will provide the peace and stability for ships that are transiting these waters. Now, my own personal view is that that is antithetical to our strategic interests and actually antithetical to Chinese strategic interests. And we've got to be very clear that those steps are not acceptable to the United States. And if you trace one issue back into our history, right, the first time that the United States ever used its forces on the international scene with the Barbary Pirates, it was around the issue of freedom of commerce, freedom of navigation, and freedom of the high seas. So this would be the one issue that I'd be very clear with Chinese friends that we're not going to adjust our perspective, and they need to rethink their overall position.
So, Dmitry, where do you see this coming down here? How far is China going to go on this, and what will the Western powers do in response to that?
Well, I think if you look back over the last 10 years, one of the things that Hu Jintao may have wanted to have done more in the South China Sea, but there were limitations because the Chinese Navy lacked ships. And if you look at just a simple chart of the number of Chinese Coast Guard ships that they've built up over the last probably 10 to 15 years, there's actually a very strong correlation with what they're doing in the South China Sea, the way they are being very assertive towards their neighbors, and the number of ships they have, and the extent to which they can go out to sea, how far they can go from shore. So China now has a capability to do things it didn't have 10 years ago, and I think that's a big part of the issue here. What can the US do? It's very difficult, because short of actually a military confrontation, what can you do? You can sail ships through the 12-mile nautical zones around some of these features that China claims, but the US and others say is part of international waters. You know, that will make a point, but it's not going to stop China from doing what it's doing. And I think one of the clever things China is doing is that everything they're doing in these islands is happening actually at a fast pace, but also at a relatively slow pace. It's gradual, and no one action on any one feature or island is big enough that it's going to warrant a military response. So I think there's nothing that can trigger really assertive action from the Americans, and no one else has the capability. And in 10 years' time, 15, 20 years' time, you will look back, the landscape, the maritime landscape, will have completely changed. And people will ask, well, how did it happen? The answer will be, well, it was very hard to prevent. I personally do not see how the Americans can prevent it. And I slightly disagree with Kurt. I think it is in the Chinese strategic interests to take a more active role there. I think, but from the global perspective, everyone would like them to take that responsibility in a responsible way. And if they were patrolling the high seas the way the US Navy has done since World War II, well, then it would be a different question, I think.
Can I, Bob, just sure. On that? The reason why I think they have to be careful is that the shipping that basically transits these waters depends on a very sophisticated insurance set of policies on that basically govern maritime commerce. If these areas start to become judged to be more dangerous or more difficult, it suddenly alters the equation of commerce through these areas fundamentally. And so what I mean by saying that I'm not sure these actions are all in China's strategic interests, they have a profound interest in the maintenance of this system. And by heavily arming these areas, they create the potential for miscalculation, accident of the kind that we saw with EP3 in 2001. And I think some of those steps will turn out to be actually antithetical to Chinese economic and commercial actions.
Now, on to our one to watch, drone racing in Japan. Aerial drones have received their share of attention for military, business, and research applications, yet one Japanese public event is seeking to lighten the narrative. Preparations are underway outside Tokyo for a competition that is part obstacle course, part tech challenge. Drone enthusiasts and participants began practicing on a course in Chiba Prefecture with a wide variety of home-built aerial drones. Pilots complete the 500-meter-long practice course at high speeds, around 60 kilometers an hour. Event organizer Akihiro Takahashi said the race aims to heighten both piloting skills and ethics among drone users. He also expressed hope that more people will learn how fun and useful drones are. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and also check out our island tracker and maritime-specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.